Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
You're listening to the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast, Episode 11. This episode, I'm talking with National Geographic cameraman and host Bob Poole. Bob grew up in East Africa, where his father was director of the Peace Corps and later director of the African Wildlife Foundation. His family spent much of their time with the abundant wildlife that thrived there during the 1960s and 70s. Bob's unique upbringing gave him an appreciation and curiosity for the natural world, a highly adventurous spirit, and a strong sense of self-reliance. As a teenager, Bob's relationship with National Geographic began when he worked with a film crew on a documentary about elephants. 10 years later, Bob's first film as a cinematographer for National Geographic was about his sister, Dr. Joyce Poole, the renowned elephant zoologist. He is now one of the world's leading wildlife cinematographers and has shot many Emmy Award-winning films. Bob's extensive credit list includes shows for PBS, BBC, Discovery, and over 35 projects with National Geographic. In 2012, the National Geographic television-produced film War Elephants reunited Bob with his sister as they worked in Mozambique's Ngorongosa National Park to help elephants traumatized by years of civil war and poaching. Whether tracking elephants in extreme desert environments of Mali, following wildebeest across the Serengeti, or traveling roadless regions of war-torn Sudan, Bob's lifetime experience and unfailing tenacity help him capture remarkable moments. Bob, thanks so much for taking time out to be on the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast this morning. How's it going for you at the festival this year?
Oh, it's overwhelming, actually. There's so much and so many interesting things to see here. And of course, I'm learning a ton and then getting inspired, you know, because, you know, with the Big Cat Summit and, you know, all this talk about conservation, you know, we hear so many negative things, actually. But when you come here and you listen to people that are actually doing amazing things on the ground, you get inspired and you get a sense of, you know, that positive things are happening and we might be okay in the long run if we keep it up.
Well, and that's what's so great about coming here is just seeing all the new stories and just speaking to so many people and getting that inspiration of, you know, hopefully there is a good future for wildlife out there. So, Bob, this is all about kind of getting to know people and their careers and how they broke into the industry. You've done some amazing stuff. You're a cameraman and a host now. Can you tell us a bit about how it all began? What was your interest in wildlife for starters, but then how did you get into the TV industry?
It was actually all by chance, but I grew up in Africa. My parents moved to Africa when I was 3 years old, so all my first memories are of Africa. My parents were in the Peace Corps, but then were totally in love with nature and wildlife and excuse me, and my father ended up working in wildlife conservation, was the director of African Wildlife Foundation, and that was in the time when I was in high school. So his work had him in all the national parks across East Africa, and he often took me out of school to travel with him. And then on all of our family holidays, we always were camping in the bush, and we kept wild animals for pets, and we just, you know, I grew up collecting snakes and lizards, and I was in it from the beginning. When I was 17 years old, my father organized a school holiday job for me working with a game capture team, and sadly he died in a car accident after he had organized that, so he wasn't around when I went to do the job, but the helicopter pilot that was doing the flying for darting these Cape buffalo that we were capturing and translocating to a place where they'd be safe away from people, went off to fly for a National Geographic film crew, and he invited me to come with him. And then the National Geographic crew invited me to join their team when my work with the game capture was finished. And that was the beginning of my National Geographic career. I was only 17 years old, and I was guiding a film crew, and I was picking up cameras, and you know, I was it was literally was the beginning, because the cameraman was a guy named Wolfgang Baer, who actually started this Jackson Hole Wildlife Film Festival, and he was the real deal, the original, you know, wildlife filmmaker. And Wolfgang had me after I graduated from college. I went to work for him here in Jackson Hole. And then that led to another job back in Africa, filming, you know, on a film that was actually about my older sister, who had become one of the world's, you know, leading authorities on African elephants. You know, she made discoveries about infrasound and muss, and changed the way we even think today about elephants. So one thing led to another, one job after another, and eventually I was filming myself. And then I, my first job with National Geographic was also about my sister. And it was a good film called Coming of Age with Elephants. And that led to a career as a cameraman.
That's fantastic. So now you have, you're taking on this role of being a great cinematographer on the field and also hosting. There's a lot to think about with both those things. I've done both, but not so much in one go, right? I started out as a host and then I moved on to camera. And they're so taxing on their own. What's it like to merge those two things together and have to, you know, be focusing on getting great shots, but then, you know, at the same time finding those moments to turn around and talk to another camera?
Well, I think, I don't know, for me it came very easily. I came into it by complete chance, almost the same way I did with the camera work, but it suited me, the camera work did, and then it turned out this did too. I was on a behind-the-scenes segment for one of National Geographic's big epic series called Great Migrations. Then they asked me if I would like to, you know, front a show, which I did, and the show was very successful. In fact, it was nominated for an Emmy. I then was picked up on a series for PBS and National Geographic as a main character, doing the work that I was doing, which was filming and hosting and narrating. So that all sort of flowed easily together. And then my latest thing, which is this thing called Man Among Cheetah, which is very much, as you were saying, speaking while filming, because it's all like you're on this ride with me, and we're just along together for this ride. But I think that it's not so difficult in a sense. I always felt comfortable with it because I'd filmed so many people, you know, in interviews and, you know, characters on camera. And I always, you know, when things got tough for them, I always tried to say, look, you know, just relax, because we're only going to pick the best parts of this and you're going to look great. So when the camera turned on me, I just didn't care. And I never have, you know, I just be myself and I talk about what's really going on in the moment. And so it's not been really difficult for me to multitask in that way, to shoot and talk at the same time. And I also, I don't multitask on other things at all, but that one I don't seem to have a problem with. However, lately I've taken to doing some live stuff where you really have to, you can't ramble on and there's no editing, so you have to be really deliver specific words. You know, it has to be concise, and you have to deliver the message in a very concise and quick and one-time take. While I'm filming at the same time. And I think that was much more challenging. And luckily I'd been doing all this National Geographic live performances where I'm on stage for an hour and 10 minutes with no notes, and I have the script in my head. So I'd learned how to memorize what I'm going to say. And what I found with the live television was that I knew they were going to be coming to me in like 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And I had to be doing my work and also deliver the talking points that I needed to. So I had to know what they were without thinking about it. That means I had to memorize it and throw it into my head so that whatever was going on, I could still say the words. And it worked out, because like on this particular thing, National Geographic Earth Live, the second time they came to me, I was to be surrounded by hyenas. and they were literally climbing all over me, and it was, I couldn't get the words out. The second time, when it was live, they came to me. I had the words down fine, but there were no hyenas. And, you know, my mind was thinking only, oh my God, this is a complete disaster. There are no hyenas. But the words that I had memorized were just coming out naturally out of my mouth. And in the end, there were a couple of hyenas. And to the audience, it looked intense. And my delivery was fine. And so it would have totally been a disaster if I had choked and not had those words in my head. And so I couldn't have done that if I didn't have the stage experience, and knowing, you know, the Nat Geo live thing really helped me with the live TV.
So there's a lot to be said for preparation, being prepared. I mean, there's, I know this from presenting, that there's so many different styles. I mean, I found it very easy as well to be in the moment, because I was doing what I loved, right? There I was, you know, with a with the wildebeest out on the Masai Mara, and you're, you know, your grin's there because you're loving it, and you can turn around and be in the moment and enjoy it. That stuff I found easy, but then similar to you, I found it really, really hard to have scripted content. And there would be times where I remember we were doing a show for National Geographic on mosquito-transmitted diseases. And we were in India in this paddy field. And there was a water buffalo in the background with a couple of storks on its back. So you had this great contrast with the white and the buffalo and the rice in the field. And the sun was setting. And the director was like, okay, let's do this piece to camera. And this was a whole paragraph of scientific information. And so I thought, okay, I've got this. And it's like, okay, we've got to go now because the sun's going to go. 19 takes, right? It was terrible.
And the sun's gone.
Well, we got it just at the last minute. But, the storks were flying off. And
of course, the moment you start to screw up, you kind of spiral down.
Yeah, that's right. You start overthinking everything then, and then you start getting anxious. And then at that point, you've lost any kind of moment, and it's gone. So in that vein, have there been moments where you've just found yourself in the field, you know, thinking, okay, I hate this. What am I doing? Why am I doing this? Have you had those kind of moments?
You know, I have to say, luckily, I haven't had to do much that I wasn't, you know. I think that here's the trick, is if you know what it is you're talking about, you have something to say, then it's easy. If you're doing something you're not that an expert on, I think it's really tough. And luckily, I haven't had to do that yet. I mean, I'm not an expert on anything, but I have passion and I understand. And the things that I've been doing on camera have been stuff that I knew and care about. And so then it's easy, I think. I do worry if suddenly I'm asked to do something in a proper hosting thing, where then I have to actually talk about things that I don't know, then I'll have to memorize them, because I'm dyslexic. I can't read. I could never read in public or before an audience, or, you know, certainly not on camera, you know. So I think when the time comes, I'll just have to know those things. I'll have to study my lines so that when the sun's setting and the thing's going off, it's already in my head. But yeah, I can imagine how stressful that could be.
It's incredible you say that, because I'm very similar. I would never want to read anything in public. You know, memorizing it, fine, or it being a subject I'm familiar with, fantastic. But I was very, very similar. I had to really kind of work hard at overcoming the anxiety of knowing that I don't, you know, I came out of school early, didn't read very well at all. And, you know, I think this is hugely inspiring for people who are looking to get into the same kind of field, because I think people believe that they have to be these perfect kind of iconic beings to be in your position, right? They have to have everything down and understand everything and do everything perfect. And so many of the people in this industry are not like that.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, in my case, I told you my father died when I was 17, and at that time I was a hopeless student. I mean, I was a terrible student, and I did get myself through university and with a degree in science, and you know, I worked really hard because I, you know, reading didn't come easily, and in those days people didn't understand, you know, dyslexia and what that was. But being left-handed, I think, also, you know, it's like this, you know, you grow up having to do things slightly differently. You could take a gearbox and throw it on the ground and in a million pieces, and I'll put it together for you. I just don't know why, but I can assemble things like that. Now, my parents used to laugh at me because they bring these complex models, you know, like, you know, these sort of modeled whatever, motorcycles or what, airplanes, or, and I would never look at the directions. I would just stick it together, and I'm still like that. I never look at any directions. The first thing I do is throw the directions away, and my head just thinks differently in that way. But I didn't have any confidence because I wasn't a good reader, so I was hopeless in school, and I never thought I was going to amount to anything. But you know, I guess, you know, this business has given me that opportunity to do what I do well.
Well, I mean, it's fantastic. And what kind of advice would you give to people? I mean, there's a lot of people here who are looking to be camera people. They're looking to be hosts, and in general break into the industry. But for specifically with camera work and hosting, what advice would you give them? Because when they're looking at this and they see all these people and they see how finessed everything is these days, it looks like an impossible task. It's like, okay, I might as well give up now. There's so much talent around, you know, it's hopeless. Why bother? And I see I've spoken to a lot of people who are kind of down after the first few days. They're just kind of like, you know, I'm not enough. And it's really sad to see that, because I know through doing these podcasts how many of the people in this industry are not here because they did some linear kind of stepping stone path to get here. So what kind of advice would you have for someone in that situation?
Well, I have a couple things that come right to mind. One is that when I started doing this, I still had no confidence in myself. And when people started to say, oh my God, that was amazing. And when I saw the footage that I had shot ended up in the movie, and it was actually something that was really quite good. And I realized, oh my God, they took what I did and they made this movie and it's actually really good. And you know, it's you don't do this stuff on your own. You do it with a team. It's like you watch these amazing programs here, and it's like everybody had a part in it. And you know, well, you were the cameraman, so there was an editor who sifted through all your material, and they're only showing the very best of your work. You know, and then they've layered music to like make it even more dramatic, and then there's some incredible person who's speaking about an amazing thing, and so you really are just only one part of that thing, and combined is where the power is. You know, if they just sat and watched your raw dailies, they'd be like, eh, you know. So that's one thing for everybody to know. It's a team effort. But the other thing is when it comes to this stuff, I mean, everybody has their own way in. There are opportunities for people today that we never had. I mean, I was working, we shot film, motion picture film, and, you know, the camera assistant got to touch the camera, but you didn't get to look down the eyepiece, you know. The cameraman was the only one that was, you know, able to look down the lens, and you know, you never got a chance to frame up a shot and shoot anything. And it took a long time before I was ever given a camera to go shoot anything. Nowadays, everybody's got a phone, which is probably better quality than the film cameras we were shooting on. So, I mean, you know, then there's the internet that allows you to post stuff instantaneously without having a, you know, huge budget. When we used to have a 10-minute roll of film was $400 raw. Then we had to have it processed, and then it had to, you know, so now it's all free. So there is a tremendous opportunity for anybody who's starting out in this business, because you could do anything you want.
Now, speaking upon the filming and everyone having a camera now and how gorgeous everything is looking these days, because these cameras are just incredible. This is two part. First of all, people get intimidated when they see all this great stuff. I mean, here we're seeing, you know, top notch wildlife films, and for a camera person again breaking into it, and they're worried about what they're doing. I've heard this a lot where people are saying, you know, what do I go and film? that people haven't seen, because it's like, you know, Bob's out there filming all this stuff. If I go and film it, you know, it's the same stuff, or it's not, you know, it's not going to look any different, or it would probably look worse. So, you know, what advice would you give specifically about, you know, where do you start with going out and filming wildlife to try and make it in the industry?
But I think that it's been like that for a long time now, that it's all been shot already. But the fact is it hasn't, because, you know, I watched something last night, it just blew my mind, you know. Yesterday it was Born in China, and the sequence with the snow leopard coming down and trying to take a baby yak, and the yak mother defending the cow. I mean, yeah, okay, they've been out filming snow leopards for a long time and it's been super difficult, but they never got that before, you know,
right?
What I mean?
Yeah, that was incredible.
And so I think that it's never like that. And, you know, everybody has access to something. I do a lot of these National Geographic live tours, and people ask me this question a lot, and I'm just like, look, you know, there's something going on in your city or in your backyard or in, you know, your city park or whatever that nobody's stopped to look at before, and it's fascinating. Everything you look at in nature is interesting if you tell the story. So I think, you know, I'm lucky because I get to go do like cheetahs on the African, you know, bush, but there's always another good story to be told.
Well, and I think so much of the time we overlook that because we feel it has to be a snow leopard or a cheetah or a wildebeest or and there was a show here, not going to get the title right now, but Tales from Paris, something like that.
Yeah.
And it was all about pigeons and kind of urban, you know, the wildlife just in the city.
Yeah.
And again, it's just like, well, it's, you know, most of the time we're kind of kicking pigeons out the way, walking along the street.
Yeah.
But this show is about pigeons and how they're interacting with people and themselves. Mm. And it was just another great example of how you can take something so simple as right there and make a film out of it.
Well, and like, so you're doing, you know, you specialize in insects, and I mean, insects are fascinating when you get to look at them more closely and start to understand what's going on, and you'll never run out of stories to tell about insects.
They're everywhere.
Yeah.
And abundant. Yeah, absolutely. Well, and now let's move on to the gear, right? Mm. Gear is always a big one as well. You know, people feel, they see the stuff you're shooting, they feel, okay, what's he shooting on? They find you're on a, I'm not sure, F-55?
Yeah, it was.
So you know, big cameras, expensive cameras, fantastic cameras. Mm. They feel that they've got a, okay, now I need to save up or sell the house and buy one of these cameras. Mm. When in actual fact, my advice is always learn to use a $300 camera off eBay.
Yeah.
Get good with that. Yeah. And then when you're making money or, you know, you're looking to do something better, think about that. What would you say to that end?
Well, I had this rule. I did well with my equipment, and I've always owned equipment. But my rule was like, never own any equipment that's not going to pay for itself, because it's so expensive. Look, when we shot on film, and I was a steadfast, you know, working in film guy. Well, all the video cameras, we went to Betacam, we went to digital Betacam. I skipped all that. I kept shooting film. I kept getting the last film projects. And then on the last, very last film project we were on, it was a series, and they said, you know what, we're going to HD. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go buy an HD camera. The body was $100,000. That's way more expensive than we pay for cameras these days. But I was making money on the camera, so it didn't matter. I made that money back quickly. Now,
without it, you wouldn't have been earning anything, right?
Yeah. And nobody else, you know, was taking that deep plunge. But now, you know, as the industry changed, cameras come down in price and they've gotten a lot better. Now you have to be careful because, you know, the camera you buy today might be outdated in a couple of years. So you have to be, the same rule applies, you know, don't buy the equipment unless you see a path to pay for it. And like you said, there's a lot of great equipment. You don't have to have the latest, greatest thing. I mean, you can't unless you're, you know, going to have a way to pay for it. And so that's my opinion anyway. So I went for quite a few years without a camera body in my equipment room. And it was depressing. I didn't need it because I was being given cameras to use. But I wanted one in my shop, but I didn't want to buy it unless I had a clear path to to pay for it. And I finally got that clear path and I bought myself a camera. So I'm happy again. But now I want new lenses. And the problem
so
is
it never ends.
Yeah, it never ends.
Yeah, and those things cost as much as a camera half the time.
Yeah, so your point is exactly right. I mean, there are amazing tools out there that don't cost a lot of money, and you don't have to have the latest thing. And, you know, be careful because everybody is looking for 4K while we're now shooting 8K. Sorry, everybody says we have to be shooting 4K, and now we're shooting 8K. But in fact, like, most things are still being broadcast on HD, and people don't really care among most of the things that are going out there. So I have a friend who still works with an F900, which was that camera I talked about that cost $100,000, and you couldn't sell the thing for $2,000.
And yet
today.
That was the workhorse. I mean, that was the workhorse of the...
Yeah, and it makes great images, and it still does.
Right. And now worthless, pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah, but you can pick one up and start shooting with it, and your footage will look stunning.
It's incredible, isn't it? I mean, I think I call it gear envy. We get stuck on this path of seeing what other people are using, thinking we've got to have that. But it's very fickle because you see the next person, and you're like, oh, well, no, hang on, they're a different manufacturer. I want that. But at the end of the day, well, glass is so important, what lens you have on the front of it. And we're in this place where fantastic to shoot these larger formats. 4K is great. Even when you're down-resing it to HD, it still makes a nicer image. But is it necessary, especially when you're starting out? I mean, really, you know, I'm still selling, you know, high-def footage from smaller sensor cameras to news channels and what have you, because they want, I film a lot of urban bear activity in Tahoe, and it was all filmed with small camcorders, and I'm still getting top dollar for that kind of stuff because it's unique. And I think it's a bit like storytelling in general. A good story doesn't necessarily need great images, right? But great images with a bad story is not so good. And it's the same if you've got unique footage. It doesn't really matter if it was shot on an iPhone or an Arri Alexa, or, you know, it's it can still be worth something because of what's happening in the image. So,
yeah, and I mean, I would just, one other thing is that I don't really sell much stuff. It's not really worth much in the long run. So I have a collection of old stuff, and I break it out from time to time, put, you know, lenses on you know, newer cameras, and nowadays I think things are becoming more with all these different integrated lens mounts and things like this. You know, you can really mess around with stuff, and it's cool in that way.
Well, we're in a new age where, as you say, the adapters are allowing us. I film with a lot of DSLR Canon lenses on a Sony camera, and it's just the fact that you can do that and save a lot of money on cinema lenses, and you can rent those lenses very easily. You don't have to invest huge amounts of money because we just have so many options these days, which makes it very fun and very accessible for everyone. So let's talk very quickly, next projects. What are you heading on to? If you can talk about them, what are you heading on to do?
Well, you know, I'm just going out to do a thing with National Geographic Creative, which is a first for me. I'm really excited about it. That's their commercial side. And so I'm doing in Kenya, I'm working alongside of Ronan Donovan. He's a still camera guy. We're doing advertisement for Safaricom, which is the cellular network telephone company in Kenya. And so that's really fun. It's about endangered species in Kenya. So we're really excited about that. And then I've got, I'm doing a series with BBC, actually, which is really fun. It's I'm American accent and everything, but I BBC has a partnership with PBS, and so you know, I feel that need for having an American on PBS. But so it's great. So I'm working with making a lot of new friends and doing exciting stuff with really, really talented filmmakers, and that's cool. It's nice. So hopefully carry on with some of the kind of films that we've been making lately. You know, but it's with these projects, you know, it's always back to the drawing board, isn't it? You know, you get something done, and you work off of that to build the next thing. And so that's always a it's always a work in progress.
Well, and that's another big question I always hear about. You know, I think people think that once you're at a certain level, it's easy, right? Because the work just keeps rolling in, right?
Yeah, no.
And I'm not sure that's the case for anyone, right? Maybe Attenborough.
I get so much from my friends and, you know, family. It's like, oh, I'll never work again. And, you know, it's always a big joke. But the fact is, you know, I think there's a certain amount of, a certain amount of that's good because it keeps you on your toes and keeps you hungry, you know? You know, everybody gets a dry spell every now and then, and you know, you think you're done, but you know, I know that's not the case because we have been coming to this festival for I don't know how many years now. God, it's almost 20. And you know, here we all are. We're still here. We're still doing this stuff. You know, we've all been through dry times, and we've all can come out and made some amazingly cool new things. So we just, you know, that's part of this business is rolling with the tide and trying to keep reinventing yourself. I've had to reinvent myself many times over. And I think that's the exciting part about it too. You're not ever stuck really in a rut. You're always adapting and shifting in it. And I guess if you're not, you're not coming back, you know.
Right. And, you know, being someone like yourself, you know, participating in panels. You were up here on a panel just earlier talking about redefining the on-camera host, which is, you know, something that's happening now. I mean, it's happening whether we like it or not. You know, the whole industry is changing for, you know, going moving online and looking at different ways to meet our audience. What do you find is the importance of film festivals in terms of, you know, someone who's working with, you know, the top, the leading kind of networks in natural history? What's your purpose for being here? Why do you keep coming back? Because some people would just think, well, I'm not going to see him there because he's, you know, why would he be there? But I think it's still a case of networking, right? You still got to turn up and meet people and keep the whole thing going.
I think first of all, foremost, it's like, it's kind of like a family in a way. I have so many great friends. My best friends are people who I've worked with in this business. And so, you know, that's a chance to come and see all your old friends again, you know, these people that you've been through the trenches with, you know, been through amazing experiences. And, you know, here we are again, you know, and we see each other once every 2 years or so. That's for me the first thing, you know, and the social aspect of like getting together and having a beer with your old friends or a bunch of your old friends or, you know, that's to me the number one. Then it's like to see all the listen and see all the amazing things that other people are up to. And now the festival has taken on this, you know, we had the cat summit this year and last time it was elephants. And, you know, so then you're learning about all the work that's being done to conserve these things. And then the other side, which is really the important thing, is this is where all the broadcasters are, that all the people who you can partner with to do your show, you know, what it is that you want to do. And, you know, that the networking side of that, you know, which is luckily, I think, you know, for me, it's more like having fun with people rather than I don't think of it. It is networking, but it's actually just having fun with your friends, because I know I'm in this place. It's funny. I like my friends are now the executives of you know, president of channels and senior vice presidents and other filmmakers and camera people, and you know, I have friends all across this thing. So it's really just, yeah, it's not really networking. It's just hanging out with your friends.
That's fantastic. I mean, it's amazing how it all evolves. And yeah, as you say, you become very close to people. I mean, it's amazing when I worked with a very small crew traveling the world. And those people become, as you say, it's like a family. Because you go through things that most people never go through in their lives. At times when you might be, you know, scared or you're most exuberant. And, yeah. You know.
And those people back then. Then were, you know, like your producer or, you know, an AP, and now they're the president of the channel. Yeah, you know, so you have this, like, you know, we're all going through this thing together, and You know, all of us are adapting and changing and shifting and finding the new way all the time.
Well, Bob, thanks so much for taking the time out to be on the podcast. It's great to have people of your caliber on here that can give advice and just tell your personal story, because that's what this is all about. It's inspiring others to know that, you know, we all got into this in a different way, and people will continue to do that, and it's going to last a long time. And, you know, inspire people to make great quality content, because that's really, really important in this day and age. So thank you.
Thanks so much, Jake, for having me. It's been really fun.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast, then please leave a rating and a comment, and remember to subscribe to keep up to date with the series. You can find out more information on wildlife filmmaking at masterwildlifefilmmaking.com, where you'll find valuable free resources like downloadable reports and video tutorials. Thanks for listening.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.